is Andy Hunt, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
All right, that was a little snarky, but
I'll do another one. This is Andy Hunt, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast. That was serious.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Andy Clef, and we're joined today by guests Andy Hunt and Dave Thomas. Andy, it's good to have you back on the show. It's been a while. Last time we chatted was late November 2016 when we did a Manifesto co-author interview.
Boy, you got a better memory than I do, or you looked.
I looked it up. You called my secret. How you been?
Oh, been doing well. Been keeping busy. Wrote a couple science fiction novels to have something to do and stay busy. And then Dave and I kind of stumbled onto this project right here, which was kind of interesting. We had, 20 years to think about it, and then decided in the space of just like 2 to 3 months, let's do this. We've been really busy working on this, the 20th anniversary edition of The Pragmatic Programmer.
Yeah, and that's going to be the subject of the show today. Dave, welcome. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you. This is my first time. You obviously don't love me enough.
You're welcome back anytime. I think whether, at the end of the show, you'll still want to come back is up to me. And as you mentioned, you got a new title that's you're putting out in beta. It's the Pragmatic Programmer Second, or the 20th edition.
20th, yeah, it's a little, we got to work on the name a little bit. It's the 20th anniversary edition, which happens to be the second edition. The first edition came out in 2020, which the way the publishing world works really means it came out in the fall of 1999 for reasons. So we're doing the same thing here 20 years later, 20 odd years later, and they have been odd years. We're putting it out in the fall of 2019 with a 2020 copyright date on it. So it's like, think of like automobile years or something.
Yeah, well, we'll put the math in the show notes because I didn't follow that at all. So I've read the book, and I think a lot of our listeners have. And if you haven't, I'm going to give you a few random reviews that I found courtesy of Miss Google. If I had to choose one book, just one book, to elect as the number one must read for every programmer, I choose The Pragmatic Programmer. No brainer, it's just that good. Another one, this is the book that every software engineer seems to recommend to each other, and dutifully so.
I should never have taught my mother how to create accounts.
So the question is, so how the heck are you two gonna top that? What do you got in mind?
It's not so much a matter of topping it, I suppose, as reinventing it or just redoing it for now. We did the first edition for the world of the late 1990s going into the early aughts. And this is really, in a lot of ways, the same thing as the first edition, just for this place in time, in the late, whatever we call these, the 20... What is this decade even called? I don't even know.
The end of times, I think.
That's it. That's yes. Yeah, the dark times. Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, that's a valid question, though, because if we stop to think about it, there is a lot of pressure on that. But the reality is, when we wrote the first edition of the book, we had no idea whatsoever that we were going to do anything that ended up being what it was. We just wanted to write a book to basically make our lives easier when we went to see consulting clients. And we were absolutely, we were delighted, but we were just totally shocked when it took off the way it did. And the fact it's continued to sell for the last 20 years is absolutely staggering. So I think to some extent, when we wrote the updates for this 20th anniversary edition, we kind of just took the same mindset, which was, we'll do the best we can and we'll put it out there. And if people like it, that's fantastic.
As you reflected from the past to the current, what are some of the big changes that have happened in the last 20 years?
We actually made a list of that before we even started. We made a list of sort of like the top 20, I think it was, big shifts in the industry. And I mean, obviously it's 20 years. That's a lot of lifetimes in programmer speak. So we didn't cover everything that's changed, but I think we hit the highlights. It was some stuff was really kind of trivial and some stuff was deeper and more profound, but it was interesting. You'd go back and read, you know, here's a section telling you to, keep up your knowledge portfolio and to do continuous learning. And that's absolutely true. That's still true today. We didn't have to edit that, except the part where it said, oh, and go out and read all the magazines you can find. Yeah. Oh, tell me more, Grandpa. What's a magazine? You know, so there was little stuff like that where just the world has changed out from underneath us, and we had to reflect and keep up. But then there's, you know, the changes in the tech. So at that point in time, you had, I think, the sort of trend, the bulk of the trend was people who had moved from maybe learning or having a history of procedural programming, getting into object-oriented programming. And, you know, Java was riding high, and it was kind of the crest of that particular wave. So, you know, maybe a lot of our debugging advice and tips kind of echoed that flavor of the time, that's where everyone was. That's a different world now, right? You know, the shiny new kid on the block is a functional approach. And you make a different class of mistakes, you know, going into that with an object mindset and so on.
Dave, what are some of the highlights on that top 20 changes in the last 20 years that stick out for you?
In terms of the book, I think the highlights are that we've addressed things that we hadn't before, like concurrency, for example. Concurrency was kind of like in there in an indirect kind of way. Now we have an entire chapter on it. And the reason for that, obviously, is that we are now facing a world that is concurrent and parallel. And honestly, most developers are not taught how to do that. And so that was a big deal. The other thing that's changed, I think, is that both Andy and I are older. Andy is obviously considerably more older than I am, but we're both older. And we've had, you know, a bunch more experience. We've also had a lot more experience talking about the stuff in the book. And so we found different ways to express some stuff. So when we come across things where people had questions, and probably the most notoriously misunderstood quote is the don't repeat yourself dry principle. When we come across those kind of things where people just misunderstood it or, you know, didn't get the full breadth of it, then now is the opportunity we have to come back in and explain ourselves better. So for me, I think the pleasure comes from partly the new stuff, but also I don't think there's a single page in that book that hasn't been either touched up or totally rewritten. And a lot of that is simply saying the same thing, but trying to say it just that little bit better.
20 years of perspective and questions. A toss-up question. Is there anything else on that top 20 in the last 20 that really is significant?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's sea changes of how we do things. I mean, the 1990s were, you know, AOL carpet bombing the world with CD-ROM. Right. You know, right. We would just, you know, not even like the focus of a tip, but as the background environment talk about, you know, the build machine in the corner. Well, it's not in the corner, is it? It's in the cloud. You know, it's a different way of doing things. And that drives this and that drives that. So.
Well, I don't forget the agile stuff, right? Because when the book was written, it was before the meeting in Snowbird. And so although a lot of the book informed that meeting, the terminology did not exist at the time we wrote the original edition. And so what we tried to do is to tie things back into what we think is the spirit of agility. And along the way, we're taking the opportunity to take a swipe at the things that are currently being touted as agility that we don't think are.
Yeah. There's a huge rift that small a, big A opens up. Maybe we can get into that later.
Yeah.
Well, and with anything else, I mean, we try very hard to sort of cut to the heart of the matter and be like, this is the important part. You know, forget all that stuff along the sides and forget where all the noise and the smoke is. This is the important part you need to know. So, you know, the agile discussion, that's a long one. I mean, we could do a whole hour long podcast just on that.
But, absolutely.
You know, I've seen too many people who have the attitude that they do half of Scrum badly and they use a tool like Jira and say, well, okay, well, we're agile because we have these things. It's like, no, that's not enough. And that's just where do I begin? Okay, well, here, this is what you really should do. So that's what we've got.
Well, and if I take that a step further, one of the things we say explicitly in the book is if someone tells you this is how you become agile, or this is what you do to be agile, then they're lying to you, right? Because there is no way to follow a recipe and to be agile any more than there is a way to follow a list of move this muscle, then move this muscle and be an Olympic gymnast, right? The only way to be agile is to use feedback and is to basically practice and to modify what you do based on what you learn. So one of the things we do in the book explicitly is we have one tip or one section, which is purely the essence of agility. And we express all of it in, you know, 3 bullet points. And all the rest of it is just, you know, make it up around this. Because if you sit there and try and take a course and, you know, buy some books and then follow along, you're not going to get it. It's just not going to work for you. Because agility is not, you know, is by definition not following a certain set of rules.
Yeah, and worse than that is the organizations that subscribe to that, follow, install the tool, install the system, and when it doesn't produce the results promised, blame the tool.
Oh, there was just a marvelous conversation on Twitter just this week where I forget who it was, so apologies, but somebody said they were at a client, and the client said, "Oh yeah, we do continuous integration. We have a Jenkins server. No one pays any attention to it. We don't use it, but we have it. So yeah, we're doing CI/CD because we've got one of those things you mentioned. Yeah, we have one of them. Yeah,
actually, you know what I think is even worse than blaming the tool is I've seen organizations where they bring in some ridiculous quote enterprise agile tool, and it initially works thanks to the Hawthorne effect. But after a while, it just, you know, grinds back down to the way it was. They don't blame the tool. They blame the developers.
Yeah. You know?
And all these developers are doing are desperately trying to get a job done in this kind of tide of, you know, sloshing back and forth. You know, you're supposed to do this and then fill in the TPS reports and blah, 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 blah. Right. They just want to get their job done. And now they're being blamed because they're following the rules.
That's kind of the worst of both worlds. And it's unfortunately all too common. You know, and you talk about enterprise agility. I mean, that's, I don't want to get into that too deep, but that's kind of an oxymoron.
Well, no, it's not. No. I disagree. I think an enterprise can be agile. Take, for example, the United States Marine Corps. Right? The Marine Corps, I would argue, is a relatively agile organization. But it's only agile because it's 100% from top to bottom agile. Right? If you had, you cannot have an organization that has agile software developers and a conventional management structure, right? Because that impedance mismatch in the middle will destroy any aspect of agility. There's no feedback. But if you have an entire organization, maybe SpaceX, I don't know, maybe SpaceX is agile. It certainly gives the impression of being that, you know, if you can rock and roll, and if the whole organization can rock and roll, if the whole organization is in the same feedback loop, then I don't see why you can't have enterprise level agility. I mean, I agree, it's a very rare bird.
Yeah, the big thing you mentioned there that I think is the important point is that you've got all these divisions, these sections that are able to act as autonomous units. They're able to get out in the field, know the goal, but then make their own decisions on the ground to make it happen. And that's absolutely critical. And, you know, organizations like the Marines are adept at that because that's the field you're in. And you try to put a more traditional hierarchical management graft or traditional accounting methods or traditional whatever with other agile parts of the organization, it's a recipe for unpleasantness.
Absolutely. Yes, and you take these independent self-learning field units, and that's one layer of an enterprise agility system. And you take the learnings that they get and you feed them back into the larger organization, which shares in enhances and propagates those learning, and then suddenly you have a learning organization.
Yeah, except be very, very careful when you express that, because I think I agree with what you said, but other people might misinterpret it, because what you said was that we take what these independent units have done and we integrate it into the rest of the organization, right? And I think that's the mistake people make, right? Because what works for A may not work for B. And instead, so I think probably what you're saying is the rest of the organization has visibility into what A does and can adopt and adapt what they do to their own particular circumstances.
Yes, that's much more eloquent.
The key of it right there is that being able to adapt it, right? That's the absolute key. So anytime you see someone talking about canonical agile or some, you know, phrase like that, it's like, no, you've killed it stillborn right there. That's dead. That's not how it works. You have to continually adapt. You get someone who says, oh, you know, we're an agile team. Have you changed how you do things in the last year? No, we've done exactly the same way for 3 years straight. You're not agile then, right? Things should be changing. That's sort of the whole point. You have to adapt. If your circumstances haven't changed in 3 years, okay, maybe you get a buy.
No, but even then, what you're supposed to do is fuzz it, right? You're supposed to introduce random change. I mean, maybe not random, but you need to introduce change just to prove to yourself that you are actually at a local optimum point, right? So, you know, you may say, I mean, one of my favorite, I love doing this one because it always gets like, you know, people cross themselves in the audience. You know, I will say to people, hey, do an iteration without unit testing. See what happens.
Can you hear the silence? Can you hear the silence in the audience?
Oh, it's great. It's great. But the reality is people will be surprised. It's not what you think when you stop unit testing for an iteration. And that's all I'm going to say.
The rest is in the book.
No, but the point I'm trying to make is you've got to, if you've got a good enough team, you can rock and roll, you can do anything you want and see what happens, right? It's not going to be the end of the world. I mean, the entire point of having a 1 or 2 week iteration is even if the entire thing goes south, all you've done is lost 2 weeks. But it's not going to go south, you know?
And you're going to have learned something.
And you're going to learn a lot, right? But it's not going to go south. It may not go optimally, but it's not going to go south. It's going to be, maybe you'll get 9 days worth of work done rather than 10, but maybe you'll get 12 days worth of work done. You know, arithmetic loss, geometric gain. That's the way it works.
Yeah. The flip side of my first question of what has changed in the last 20 years is what has stayed this? And what I'm hearing is pragmatism, right? Instead of dogmaticism.
Yeah. And part of that, I think, is, you know, obviously the big thing that hasn't changed in 20 years is people, right? We haven't changed in hundreds, thousands of years, maybe.
We're just as stupid now as we were back then.
Exactly. Some cases, maybe a little bit worse. So, yeah, the tech comes and goes, and that changes. And, you know, we can't talk about things like CORBA or RMI or Motif or OpenLook because people give you that funny look, Grandpa, what are you talking about? So fine, that's it. But all the stuff about how to work together in a team, how to talk to users, to understand their needs, to understand what is going to work for them, you know, trying to avoid, capturing that in some incredibly god-awful legal document and instead actually learn and understand them and their needs and being able to provide for that. None of that's changed. None of that's changed since the dawn of the industry. That's all the same.
Let me just take that a step further, right? Because I don't know what the half-life of knowledge is in our industry. I'm guessing it's about 4 years. And so if we were to write a book, which was, you know, how to use RxJS or Vue.js or whatever else it might be at the moment, right? By the time it actually gets into print, the chances are it's going to be 50% out of date. And certainly, you know, within a year or two, it's going to be pointless. So instead, we wanted to look at the things that aren't going to change. And what's not going to change is the reasons for using different frameworks or different technologies or different approaches. And so we wanted to go beyond the technology and look at the motivation. And so you can make your own decisions in the environment you find yourself 20 years from now. right? When, you know, all of the stuff we've got right now will be totally ridiculous in the same way that punch cards are to us now. And the drivers for those decisions that you make will still be the same. And so I think what we tried to do is to capture those as the kind of invariant properties of development.
And in that framework, the half-life of that kind of knowledge is much different than technical or software-based knowledge.
Absolutely. I mean, you can go back to, what year was Fred Brooks? That was
mid-70s.
Mid-70s. You know, Mythical Man Month, if you ignore the particulars of the technology involved, it's spot on today. Spot on. It's the exact same thing. And that's been so many decades. So, the half-life there is probably, you know, half a century or more.
Well, more than that. I mean, if you look back, even like back to Stevenson Brunel, even Brunel, right, doing heavy engineering, bridges, railroads, this kind of stuff, was still adapting agile principles. He was still looking at his users and getting feedback, doing lots of small experiments, all that kind of stuff. Edison, same kind of thing. This is not a development specific set of concepts. This is really how to work creatively in a constrained environment.
It goes back to medieval cathedrals.
Well, yeah, right? Our old stonemasons.
Stonemasons. I mean, you touch on that in the book, I think. It was empirical. You know, you built it fell over, or you built it and you threw another flying buttress. You didn't quite know why it worked and the cracks didn't develop. But it works.
Yeah, actually, I am not 100% convinced by that, because they have found some really beautiful scale models that people have used to experiment with things like how thick does this have to be and this kind of, how strong does this have to be. A lot of it was over-engineered because they didn't actually have the modeling to be able to tell. But I think they did have some of the underlying concepts worked out. Like the shape of a buttress is not something you would just like wing. Right, so they clearly had to have worked out, you know, how to calculate the shapes of buttresses.
The important thing from that to us is you've got to get out there and try it.
Right, exactly.
Model it, you configure it, but at the end of the day, you have to try it. And like you say, the first one fell over, the second one fell over, the third one caught fire, fell in the swamp, and you know the whole thing. But you keep trying and you keep fiddling with it. And one of the ways we get into trouble, probably the single worst way we get into trouble on any project, is we do something that ignores feedback. You impose some kind of a strict hierarchy or a strict process or any kind of a thou shalt, and you've cut off some avenue of feedback because somebody somewhere knows better and you're supposed to do it this way, and now you're dead.
Right.
It's like, what's that Oregon Trail? You've died of dysentery. Boom, you're dead. You know that.
But I mean, take it a step further, because you were talking there about you try, it fail, you try, you fail. And I think that's a very important lesson, which is to do with, right, basically sticking at it and knowing that it's okay to fail. But there's another part of that which is also really critical, and it's to do with engineering as well. And that is, after you've succeeded, you need to try. Glenn Vandenberg talks about bridge building and how in the old days, people used to build bridges that would not fall down because basically they had a lot of material in them, right? I mean, I could build a bridge that would never fall down, but it's filling the entire valley with rocks, right? But, you know, gradually become more and more sophisticated. What happens is engineers constantly are driven to try and save money and, you know, to show off a bit. And they will cut back on materials. They will use thinner steel or whatever it might be. And the point he makes is eventually a bridge falls down and then they all learn from it and do it again. And that's the kind of process we have to follow as well, right? We never just sit back and say, yeah, that worked, let's keep going, right? You're going to sit there and you're going to experiment with your materials to say, okay, now what would happen if I didn't do that? Or, you know, if I did this instead or whatever it might be.
It's the inquisitive nature that comes into it.
It's more motivated than just inquisitive. Kind of like says, you know, you know, you imagine, like, you know, someone putting a finger to their lips, pursing their lips, looking up to the sky, going, I wonder what, right? No, we live in a world where our timescales are being reduced and the costs are coming down, and we have to deliver more for less all the time if we're going to be competitive, right?
And in the same way that bridges need less.
Same with bridges. More. Yeah, exactly the same with everything. Anytime you end up with a competitive technology, you got to deliver more for less. Like, I was talking to the tree guy, the arborist that comes around, and he now has a lawn business simply because he was being undercut by every person who has a 16-foot trailer and a chainsaw, you know? So he basically has to get into that market just to show them that, yeah, I can do this as well, you know? It's crazy. It's that kind of world. So people, and that comes back to the Marines, right? Because the success of Marines, step back. If you haven't done so already, I strongly recommend going online and finding a copy of the book War Fighting, right? All one word, W-A-R, Fighting. And it is the official handbook of the United States Marine Corps. And it is one of the best written books on how to be agile I have ever read. If you skip over the bits that says things like, and now kill them. but it is all about the entire philosophy of the Marines is that they send in small groups, 10 to 12 people, and they send them in with an objective, but no plan. And then what they do is they basically create chaos, right? So for example, they will send their guys into a city and then start shelling the city because their guys know how to behave in chaos better than the other guys do. And so they win by being able to improvise and being agile on the spot, yeah? And that's, it's not always as dramatic as that, but fundamentally, the entire point of the book is you have to be agile, right? How do you demonstrate? How do you lead with agility? How do you become part of a team with agile, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? That spirit of war fighting is the same spirit of entrepreneurial. I mean, because we live in a chaotic world. Everything is chaotic.
Absolutely.
So knowing how to be part of a team where the rules are changing every 2 minutes, it's vital, absolutely vital. Right? And part of that is constantly having to adapt to what you do and what you produce.
And it's been like that for the last 20 years, and it's just the speed of change.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look ahead 20 years from now, and you're doing the 40th anniversary version of this book, what?
Oh, the pace of change would just be even faster. I mean, you could consider that right now, as we sit here today, this is the slowest the pace of change will be in our lifetimes. It's monotonically increasing. So, you know, it might go faster, a faster rate or a slower rate during some periods of time or others, but it's not going backwards. So what we're experiencing right now is the slowest.
See, okay, when I first started, I think it was possible to know everything there was to know about software, about computing.
Oh, absolutely. You could read Byte magazine, right, and cover all the...
No, before Byte, because it, you know, it got more complicated when we started getting into PLAs and this kind of stuff. But, you know, back in the early 70s, mid 70s, it was a tractable field. And I kind of like spent a lot of my time trying to maintain some degree of coverage of the whole field. And I think probably just about the time the first edition of the Pragmatic Programmer came out, I gave up because it got to the point where I don't think you can. I don't think one person can encompass the entire field anymore. And to me, that's kind of sad, but it's also a sign of maturity in the field. So really, I guess one of the measures of growth is how many brains does it take to encompass the entire field, you know, and how just how diverse is that field? What's the bus number of computing? So I have no idea right now, but I would if I had to guess, I would say that it would take many tens of people to give decent coverage to all of the things that programmers do.
Andy, what does the next 20 years look like through your lens?
It's a good question. So when we wrote the first edition, issues of security and privacy were there, but they weren't particularly a big deal. In fact, it was kind of funny. We had some offhand comment in the first edition. We were talking about coupling and how, you know, spies and dissidents would do this thing where you just organize in little cells so the knowledge doesn't get spread too far in case you get compromised. And we made the bold statement that, but, you know, as developers, we don't have to be as paranoid as spies and dissidents. Well, that was 20 years ago. Today, we do. In fact, have to be at least that paranoid, if not more, because all the code that we write, every project we're putting out there is, you know, contains attack vectors, attack surfaces. So no matter what little tiny thing you're doing, if it's a personal project for your, you know, neighborhood or, you know, whatever, anything you put out there can get attacked. And that may or may not have, you know, bad ramifications for you, but you have to think about that now. It's a big deal. That's going to be a bigger deal, I think. I don't think that's getting better anytime soon. You know, the fundamental issues of identity and authentication, you know, all those sorts of things, that's kind of messy. There's no real great solutions, and we're charging ahead anyway. So, you know, the fact that you can you know, inject malware into an NPM repository or into Ruby gems or whatnot from one slip password somewhere, that's pretty fragile. You know, the fact that, you know, to do what was it, like a hello world in React takes what, thousands, 1500, you know, some thousands of modules. That's kind of building a house on sand a little bit. So we're getting away with it for right now. 10 years from now, that's probably not going to be as likely. We'll have to come up with something a little better.
So I'll chuck it back to you, Dave. Predictions on what the 40th anniversary edition of the Pragmatic Program is going to look like.
It will be directly implanted into programmers' brains as a requirement of being a programmer. I think I was reading an article in the ACM last month that said that less than 1% of the processors in Europe are in conventional computers. So 99% of them are in various kinds of device embedded into things or whatever else.
Automobiles,
fax machines, but, you know, routers, this kind of stuff, and mechanical processes, you know, engineering, factory engineering, this kind of stuff. And yet, when we talk about programming, almost implicitly nowadays, we're talking about developing for user interfaces, typically the web, and we don't talk about all that embedded stuff. And yet the embedded stuff is 99% more in terms of number of processors than the non-embedded stuff. So I think that over time, that's reality is going to strike home. And so if I was to look for a big change, and it's not going to take 20 years, it's going to take 5 years. The big change will be that we will no longer be talking about frameworks that make it easier to write web applications. Thank God. Instead, we're going to be developing code that drives, you know, little low power ARM processors and a million of them at the same time. And how are we going to do that? And then Andy's talk about security gets even more important because people's lives are literally on the line. I mean, it's a rare programmer nowadays who has life and death at their fingertips. But once we start programming all these devices, suddenly every programmer is going to have that responsibility. And right now, we don't know how to handle that.
Well, on that uplifting note, Dave.
No, I mean, I think that it is uplifting in that, honestly, we have got this. I mean, Fred Brooks said that programmers are like poets, that we construct castles from nothing, right? You know, we construct out of the air, using from there. Yeah. And we are doing that. And that is, we are blessed that we can sit there and think of something and then have it appear. There are, the only other people that can do that are magicians, right? Mm-hmm. And we have a second blessing, which is also a curse. And that is because of our ability to do that, we can help shape the future. And what we need to do as a, quote, community is to take that as a responsibility as opposed to as a game, right? We're not, right now, our motivations are, hey, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, hey, let's go out and do this because we can. And as we are increasingly, I mean, think about how Twitter has changed the world forever. I mean, it's not just, you know, oh, you can communicate what you had for dinner. It is changing politics. It's changing emergency response. It's overthrowing dictatorships, right? And that's some stupid app that lets you post text messages, right? So as developers, we can change the world. And I think we need to be taking on more of the responsibility behind that. Not on our own. I think we need to make that a broader conversation, but we need to be at least acknowledging that that problem is there. But if we do, and if we take that on seriously, then I think that's the most uplifting thing I can possibly say, because ours is a world to create. And that is phenomenal.
Yeah, I like that perspective. And if we're thinking about our work and we're caring about it as a craft, and as you guys talk about in this edition, we're inquisitive and critical and realistic, we can make a real big difference collectively.
Absolutely.
Well, gentlemen, we're coming up on the end. I'm going to give you guys a chance to shout out anything you got coming up in the next month or so.
This is pretty much the big thing on the calendar, I have to say. This is coming out in beta on pragprog.com on May 8th. So you get the quote beta book, which is content complete. It's finished, we think. We've got everything in there we'd like. But of course, if people start reading it and giving us feedback, because it's all about feedback, we may be adding a few extra tips. We may add a chapter. We may take some stuff out. You know, we will adapt. We will improvise. We will overcome. And we will eventually turn it in and have it published. It'll be out in print in the fall. Mid-September, I think, is our current target.
We'll make sure to include a link to that website, as well as ways for our listeners to get in touch with you. So thanks to you both, Andy Hunt, David Thomas, and to you, our listening audience. And if you enjoyed this episode, give us a review, leave a rating, or some comments on iTunes. And if this is your first time tuning in, subscribe to the next podcast. If you'd like to join the discussion and share your thoughts around pragmatic programming, how to change the world for good, check out coalition.agileuprising.com. Join the conversation now. And finally, support from listeners just like you help us cover hosting podcast costs. So see the show notes for details on how you can become a supporting patron. Till next time, Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out. We're back.
Hi, this is Pragmatic Dave Thomas. You're listening to the, oh my God, I've just done, help me out here. Agile what?
That's for the blooper file.
Yeah, it is.
Uprising. Perfect.
Uprising.
Thank you.
Oh, right. Hi, this is Pragmatic Dave Thomas, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising. Want anything else?
Yeah, that's great. Gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure.
All right. Thank you much.
See ya.
Thank you, Eddie. Take care.
Bye-bye.